one of the things that came out from the Facebook files was about human trafficking. So you had people, so in a lot of these countries, if you want to find a job, you're going to find a page on Facebook. You're not going to find a website because there's not going to be websites in your language. Like, as English speakers, we take for granted that a huge fraction of the internet is in English. And for most languages in the world, remember, there's 4 or 5,000 languages in the world, there's almost nothing online other than on Facebook. So you're going to go and find a Facebook page that is offering you jobs. And now you have this problem, which is, how are you going to tell if this page is a fraud? Right? Like, one of the challenges that like was detailed in the files was Facebook internally knew that some of these pages were trafficking people, and they were debating over should they warn people who interacted with them, because that might be the only way anyone would know as they were looking for a job with this group that this was actually a dangerous interaction.
How can I help? How can I be useful in ending needless suffering? Do not be afraid of work that has no end.
We have to organize a social movement.
We have an opportunity to lead by example versus just talking, hot air. I think the more people in this fight, the more we grow. Eventually, it could change. You know, the people are the ones that can make the change.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Change Agents, an Ironclad original, proudly presented by Montana Knife Company. Today's episode is with advocate and Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen. In 2019, she was recruited to Facebook to be the lead product manager on the Civic Misinformation team, which dealt with issues related to democracy and misinformation, and later she worked on counter-espionage. She became alarmed over Facebook's prioritization of profit over safety and security, and finally blew the whistle by providing the Wall Street Journal with a series of alarming internal documents about the company's practices. The series of articles that resulted are known as the Facebook files. You can find them on Google, or you can go down into the show notes and click directly on them. Frances has testified in front of the US Congress, UK and EU parliaments, the French Senate and National Assembly, and has engaged with lawmakers internationally on how to best address issues on social media platforms. Let's get into the episode.
I came to Silicon Valley in 2006. I always said I would never live in California. So my father grew up in California, and I had all of the California hostility of an ex-Californian, even though I had never lived there. And I joined Google. So I got one job offer. So I went to a brand new unaccredited college called Olin College of Engineering. It's like a lab school for developing new engineering curricula. And I get this one job offer, and it's at Google. So I'm like, I guess I'm going to California. And I ended up spending about 15 years in Silicon Valley. So I worked on search quality for a long time at Google because I loved it. At one point, I was the entirety of the search quality team on Google Books because no one loved books, but I loved books. I worked on, I introduced the first computer vision algorithms at Yelp. I was the head product manager for ranking, so how you pick out the pins on the home feed at Pinterest. So I got this really rich education on the invisible parts of the products we use every day. So this is not like what color should the button be? It's like, why should you see this result or that result on Google? Why should you see this pin or that pin on Pinterest, or what restaurant on Yelp? And so I got contacted by Facebook in like December 2018, January 2019, about working at Facebook. And I will fully admit I was kind of flippant with them. I was like, I would never work at Facebook on anything other than like how toxic it is. And they were like, well, we have this job working on civic misinformation. And so I thought this was going to be around like Macedonian troll farms from this. That was the problem in 2016. It was like they were totally blind that there was this whole cottage industry putting out blogs saying that like the Pope endorsed Donald Trump, right? And I showed up at Facebook, and it wasn't anything like that. So, I've never wanted to work at a nonprofit. I've never been like on the forefront of, what's ethnic violence in Africa. And suddenly you know, I wasn't working on, you know, fact checking, or I wasn't working on what was happening in the US. I was working on how did Facebook contribute to things like ethnic violence in African countries or in Southeast Asia. So another little piece of context, right when I joined, the UN came out with a report in great detail, like we're talking 200, 250 pages, talking about how did Facebook or Facebook's negligence contribute to the deaths of like tens of thousands of people in this Southeast Asian country called Myanmar a couple of years before. Mm-hmm. And I was, I would say, pretty overwhelmed. Like I had always had like a very Silicon Valley mindset. Like when I worked on ranking for the Pinterest newsfeed, like I never thought about, you know, how could this impact people's lives differently outside the United States than inside the United States. And now I was at a company where, you know, I learned Facebook had gone into other countries and subsidized their data to like use on their phones if mm-hmm. they used Facebook. And as a result, in lots of countries around the world, there was a 10% margin more people who would say things like, I use Facebook, than said, I use the internet, because they didn't even realize there was a difference, right? And so I'm now in this environment, and it's just super chaotic. Like 3 months into working on like, how are we going to deal with how Facebook's lack of safety systems in an African country might lead to ethnic violence, they take me off this project and they say, we've caught a Russian influence operation that is sending misinformation to police officers, right? Sending misinformation to African-American activists, to gay activists, environmental activists. We have never thought about targeted misinformation before. We've only ever thought about viral misinformation, like, you know, something that makes the company like look like they have egg on their face. We've never thought about, you know, maybe they're sending misinformation to your elected official, or like abusing the ads targeting system. Like we've never thought about this. Go figure it out. I mean, it was just all over the place. And so I tried really, really hard for about 18 months. I just like think 60, 70, 80 hour weeks. Like you try as hard as you can with like no resources, because like the consequences are just so large. And then right after the election, they dissolved the entire part of the company that was assigned to work on problems like this. And they told us, you're so important, we need to integrate you into the rest of the company. And that was kind of my turning point, when I was like, Facebook can't solve these problems on their own. Like if they don't get help from the outside, they're not going to be able to figure out what to do. And that was what, you know, it's been my path ever since.
Well, I'm glad you broke down how people use Facebook overseas. It wasn't something that I realized until I actually spent some time in Africa, outside of the military, and just interfacing. I was actually building schools at the time in collaboration with a nonprofit of a for-profit company that I was working for. Super long-winded story, but it's not the same. It's the primary method and means of communication in a lot of these areas, where I think a lot of people, especially in the first world, they look at it as, well, I just, you know, I have my smartphone. I'm going to text somebody. I'm going to call somebody. It's a completely different ecosystem. And I, in the moment watching there, this specifically was in Kenya, it's like, oh, what an interesting move by Facebook to subsidize that. What an interesting net to cast out there to capture just about everybody. So I'm very glad that you brought that up, because it truly is different. And I think for some people, they wouldn't understand, like, well, how could it possibly contribute to human trafficking or loss of life? It's just a social media app. I go on it for 30 minutes a day. How could that possibly cause that? It's just diametrically opposed to the use I would describe it as in the first world. Would you agree?
I'll give you an example. So one of the things that came out from the Facebook files was about human trafficking. So you had people, so you know, in a lot of these countries, if you want to find a job, you're going to find a page on Facebook. You're not going to find a website, because there's not going to be websites in your language. Like as English speakers, we take for granted that a huge fraction of the internet is in English. And for most languages in the world, remember there's 4,000 or 5,000 languages in the world, there's almost nothing online other than on Facebook. So you're going to go and find a Facebook page that is offering you jobs. And now you have this problem, which is, how are you going to tell if this page is a fraud, right? Like one of the challenges that like was detailed in the files was Facebook internally knew that some of these pages were trafficking people And they were debating over, should they warn people who interacted with them? Because that might be the only way anyone would know as they were looking for a job with this group that this was actually a dangerous interaction.
What was the argument against warning them?
Oh, this is actually kind of an amazing story. So when this was reported in the Wall Street Journal, one of the things that was contentious, or like they had to ask for comment from Facebook, was the stated reason, or like the way they described it, was that Facebook employees were concerned about offending people who might be hiring these people, like offending the buyers by implying that they were, you know, enslaving people. Facebook's comms people pushed back and said, there's no way a Facebook employee was more concerned about offending the buyer than preventing someone from being trafficked. And the Wall Street Journal gave them a few details. Like, they can't tell you, like, go look up this document. Like, no, this happened. They can give you some details being like, oh, you know, it happened around this time. Like, and, you know, maybe you might want to look for this word. The comms team declined to push back again. Because the issue, and this is one of these problems you see over and over again, is that Facebook really struggles with the fact that it is a two-sided marketplace, right? That there are places in the world where there are very different labor expectations. So the context here was, it was people coming out of Kenya, out of other places in Africa, going to the Middle East. And in the Middle East, your employer usually takes your passport. Like, it can be very hard to escape once you are in one of these relationships. End up having to kind of take a moral position that might offend users in those countries?
It's the classic argument of, or not argument, but discussion of paralysis by analysis, because there's no way to make any decision without offending somebody somewhere. And I can just imagine these teams, and I have no idea how large they were, and maybe you can provide some insight to that. I can imagine them grinding to an absolute halt, because any idea that's brought to the table will have a counter argument. And then there's a counter argument to the counter argument that was brought up, and they're like, okay, I guess we don't do anything and we hope the internet sorts itself out.
Well, I think there's a cultural flavor. So like, one of the things that's not necessarily obvious from looking at Facebook from the outside. So sitting on the outside, looking at Facebook, you say, you're a big, powerful company. You must acknowledge there are power differences in the world, right? And internally, Facebook, you know, think about this, like, so Facebook rose as kind of a challenge to more hierarchical ways of interacting with the world. So, for example, you as a podcaster are able to grow a platform without being part of the New York Times, without being part of the Wall Street Journal. You know, you're a part of this flat, more flat world. Facebook grew up to say, we are flat. We don't have hierarchy. Anyone has equal access. They believe in it so much, they built the world's largest open floor plan office in the world. It's a quarter of a mile long. It's 5,000 people. It's basically an aircraft hangar. Very cold, not a great office. We are facilitating an interaction that would otherwise not happen, right? Like, we are connecting as people. If we have information because people have complained about what's happened to them before, you know, do we have a duty to warn? Or is it truly like, it's not, you know, we're just the pipes that connect. It's not our place to get involved.
I hope you are enjoying season 2 of Change Agents, which is an Ironclad original. And if you are a fan of the podcast, you know that we are presented by Montana Knife Company, which from where I am sitting right now is a short 2-hour drive, maybe 120 miles due south towards Missoula. I was first exposed to this brand through its founder, Josh Smith. And actually, when I first met him, I wasn't even aware of what Montana Knife Company was. He sat across the table from me. We had a conversation, and I have been a fan ever since. This was a few years ago, and the velocity and trajectory of that company is unbelievable. I directly associate that growth with who Josh is, what he stands for, and what he puts into his product. So a little bit more about Josh. He's been making knives for 30 years. They're made in the USA. They have a multi-generational warranty and free sharpening. They're designed, tested, and they're built by hunters, and MKC's a hunting knife company first and foremost. They sell out their knives sometimes in under 60 seconds. And if you want to see what they have available or what's coming up, surf over to MontanaKnifeCompany.com. They have a new knife drop every Thursday at 7 p.m. Here's what I'm going to say on that. Practice checking out. As ridiculous as that sounds, you need to have your credit card information loaded and practice the checkout process because they go like that. I cannot even count the number of times I have had a knife taken from my cart because somebody was faster to purchase it than I was. People ask me all the time, what's my favorite blade of theirs? I go with the Mini Speed Go. It is my everyday carry knife. I don't use it for knife fighting. I use it for things that I need a knife for, so usually opening boxes. But it is my favorite blade, and if you're a fan of working knives made for working people, I highly suggest that you check out Montana Knife Company. And I'm going to add to that. Let's talk a little bit about the warranty. They have the best warranty program in the industry. No matter if you bought the knife from them directly, or bought the knife from a friend, or it was gifted to you, or if you even found the knife, they're going to honor the warranty for the life of the blade. How awesome is that? Couldn't be more proud to have them as the presenting sponsor of Change Agents. They are a fantastic organization. How frustrating was it, though, when your job was literally tasked to find these things and then you don't have the tools or the mechanism to do anything about it?
I think the thing that was the moment that was, like, for me, like, incredibly scary was I wrote about this in my memoir, The Power of One. You know, at one point, I was tasked with building this tool that was trying to be able to find people who had influence on the platform so that they could, you know, and this is actually part of the idea of how do you make sure that people who have influence but aren't formal actors, we'll say, you know, an elected, someone who has an elected role has a formal role. Mm-hmm. There's other people in society that have a lot of influence. They deserve to be the same protections that, say, that an elected person does. How do you find them? So I'm building this tool and my tool starts to break and I start digging into why is it breaking? And I end up discovering that there are tens of thousands of accounts spread across the United States where they look like real people. You know, they've been doing messages to each other. They're, you know, occasionally putting comments. They look like real people, but they're also looking at 3,000, 10,000 profiles a week in ways that look automated. Right? Like they exhibited a whole bunch of behavior, which I won't sum up here. You can go read if you want to. But I felt very confident I had found like a distributed network. Like they basically put maybe a little application on their computers. Maybe people knew about it. Maybe they didn't. Maybe they're getting some money. Maybe they weren't. Who knows? And I went to the scraping team and said, hey, like, look at this. Like this could be potentially very dangerous. Like right now they're just like looking at profiles. Like they're stealing data. That's not great, but I mean, like, it's not that bad. But imagine if those same little applications suddenly started posting. Like you could make it look like the US had been invaded or like some other chaos by like just switching how you use this program. Isn't that a problem? And because the scraping team was tasked with finding situations where other computers were threatening the system, you know, they're downloading millions and millions and millions of things, like things where the computers are at risk, not the people are at risk. I couldn't get anyone to look at it except our threat investigator team.
Yeah, that's horrible. You know, you look at it from a military context. I look at that, you know, say there's 10,000 of those. I'm going to call them bots. My words, not yours. Let's say that they're out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. The first thing they're going to do, the smartest thing to do is reconnaissance. You get into place. You're not confrontational. You sit back and you watch and you listen and you learn and you get an understanding of what's going on in the pattern of life. And I would put it right into what you had described. Like, you know, maybe it's not malicious up front, but if you weaponize those and you switch them, and that is one of my main concerns as well, is especially with the advancement of AI, even though I realize we haven't had a singularity and it's limited in its scope and scale, but the ability to create lifelike pictures, the ability to write articles in at a velocity that humans can't write and then push them out via bots at a velocity that humans can't counter, all of those things combined, It's shocking to me that Facebook, and maybe it shouldn't be, maybe I'm a little bit naive, that the Facebook people trenched in those areas were more worried about a threat to the system than a threat to the people using the system. It's a very Matrix-like view.
I guess one of these challenges where, you know, part of that culture of flatness is one about objectivity, right? Like if you move the metrics, you do a good job. If you don't move the metrics, you're not doing a good job. Like it's not subjective. Like someone's not saying, oh, you did a good job. It's like, we agreed on the metrics, you moved them, you know, pat on the back. The problem with frameworks like that, or the good part about frameworks like that, is there are places where young people can really excel, right? Like I can be 23, I can have a better idea than you, and you're 35, you're 45. I make the metrics move, idea wins. You know, that's important when you have an industry like social media that is so, you know, need the voices of young people. It's bad when you encounter threats or problems that are unexpected. You know, when you have clean metrics, that's great for an operationalized problem. It's not great when you have a new novel threat. And in the case of like those people being like, oh, well, that's not my job, right? Like I don't entirely fault them, because the reality is, you know, that team was small probably. Like they had a very specific objective. If they didn't fulfill their metrics, you know, they weren't going to get their bonuses. Like maybe their jobs would be on the line. But convincing, say, their managers higher up, their scope needed to be expanded, that's like a non-trivial amount of work. Yeah. And so it's one of these things where, you know, part of why we need to have conversations around transparency, you know, how much should Facebook have to open the curtain, is right now, or even back then, people were asking, are you trying to find people weaponizing the system? And they would tell very elaborate stories about what they were doing, how committed they were, when in reality, like they just weren't committing those resources. And one of the little like kind of, I think really nice kind of scenes of life that has been painted recently is 44 US states sued Meta around Meta lying about the safety of kids. About the, you know, they said, we've never tried to addict kids. We always try to protect kids. We'll kick off kids or like under 13 year olds and we find them, you know, and in reality, all these things weren't true. It was so validating for me reading through the unsealed filing when all the redactions were lifted, was that's what I experienced in terms of information operations. You know, I knew what they were saying publicly. I knew it was happening internally and they just didn't line up. And without having laws that allow us to open those curtains a little bit or ask questions and demand answers, get answers. Like they're never going to invest enough in safety for the public.
Yeah, I could answer the question on the social media apps, specifically Instagram, and you know, we wouldn't target kids. I have now a son who's in his 20s, but two that are in their teen years. And, you know, shockingly enough, they were able to open Instagram accounts under the age that the platform would require, because all they had to do was scroll the wheel to the correct appropriate birth year with no further proof of their age or identity, and the next thing you know, boom, they're on these systems. And I have watched their interaction. I am on social media. I was a late adopter to it as well, into the late mid-2010, actually even after, probably 2013, 2014, as post-military career, because I just didn't understand it. There's nobody who can say that it is not designed to keep you on that platform. And one of my consistent, you know, and I didn't create this, but if the product is free, then you're the commodity. It's not that hard to understand how these things, and let me be also very clear, like Instagram is probably the platform I use the most, and this ties into Meta because it's obviously owned by them. They get me with ads all the time. Damn, they show me stuff that I feel like I need in the moment. How do they know those things? Because of my consumption and where I spend my time. And I remind myself, man, how are these so good? I'm like, oh, because I'm the commodity. This app is free. They're designed to keep me on there for as long as possible. And the fact that they could say that they weren't targeting kids or that it wasn't addictive, I don't know why people believe it. But I also don't know how they can actually get away with that, because it's demonstrably false in almost every metric.
I'll give you some shocking tidbits from that lawsuit. So one of them was, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, others got up and told Congress, when we find a child, an under 13 year old, we take their account down. And in reality, at certain points, they had between 2.5 and 3.5 million just American accounts where a kid had been reported and they were waiting in a queue to have a human look at their account and then take the account down. To the point where like a mother wrote in and said, I've reported my child's account 4 separate times. Why is this account still up? Or for example, you know, I think, you know, any reasonable person could say, maybe you shouldn't send notifications to children during the school day. Or like, maybe you shouldn't send notifications to them after 10 p.m. You know, let them sleep. When you talk to kids, they say, when I get a notification, it distracts me. It makes me less productive. It makes me feel anxious. Like, I know I'm supposed to be in class, but my phone just buzzed. Like, what do I do? Facebook ran experiments. Well, one, they talked to kids. Kids told them these things. They ran experiments where they just stopped doing that. Turns out, kids said, it makes me feel less anxious. I feel like I can focus more. I'm more productive. Duh. And yet Facebook chose not to ship those changes because they got like 1% less usage. And they knew that Mark cared about that metric. And so we have the product we have today.
How do they justify that decision, though? And again, I can anecdotally, hopefully my daughter never watches this episode because recently she got in trouble and had her phone taken from her. And, you know, it's like I'm airing her out here a little bit. But what you're describing, the notifications, you know, I think that social media and the internet writ large is such a beautiful thing because we are more interconnected. We can see and communicate and talk with people on the other side of the world. The other side of that is I think there's, and this is my numbers, it's like an 80-20 negativity versus positivity. I'm not so sure we should know about earthquakes and catastrophes everywhere in the world that have probably been happening since the inception of humanity. I don't know if being bombarded with that all the time is necessarily great, but you can be connected. And the social circles of at least my age of children, my daughter is about to turn 16, they exist on these platforms, a variety of them, from Instagram to Snapchat to TikTok. Those are probably the three that I'm the most familiar with. But the alert thing is unbelievable. You're at dinner, bing, you hear something go off, and it instantly takes their attention. They're in the shower, bing, an alert goes off, and you'll hear them getting out of the shower to look at instantaneously. God forbid they wait for 20 seconds. And one of the biggest things I've noticed, and why I bring up my daughter, you know, slightly on the other edge of not being in trouble, is that she's staying with me right now. She doesn't have her phone. She is sleeping more soundly than I have seen in the past few years because she doesn't have when they would get alerts at 2 a.m, which might be 2 p.m. for one of their friends, in air quotes, in Australia, they react to it. And so this disassociative sleep, they're not getting their full cycle. And then, of course, they're in this phase where they're growing at like inches per month. They need to consume calories and rest as much as possible. You take that from them, you can't argue that their quality of life is better, that their cognition is better, that they're, and I just don't, I hate to think that in some room somewhere, people are saying, you know, we know all those things are true, but it'll cost us a percentage point of engagement, so screw your kids. I don't think it probably came out on a memo like that, but that's how I
feel. So one of the kind of shocking realizations I had maybe only in the last 2 months was even today, let alone 4 years ago or whenever this memo came through, I had almost no one who builds the product at Facebook has a child that's over the age of 10. Like even Mark Zuckerberg's oldest kid is like 9. That's because people in Silicon Valley generally gets a little bit older. A lot of people who found the company were like 19 or 20 when they founded it, you know, all these things together. It's also a young, you know, social media is a young person's game. And so likely no one in that room had a child that was in the relevant ages. Like they didn't have any firsthand experience. And so when you're weighing, you know, numbers and am I going to have to go disappoint my boss versus like a hypothetical thing, you're like, oh, whatever, like a little anxiety. Like we all feel a little anxious. Right. It's so easy to depersonalize the people that are on the other side of those numbers. And I think that's a huge part of all the harms that have happened at Facebook. Is this a culture that values a number over a person because there's not that space for empathy.
Hey guys, my name is Dom Rosso. I'm a Navy Special Operations veteran and owner and founder of the tactical company Crush Everything. I also train people in home defense, combatives, blade work, and advanced firearms training. Now I get to bring my years of experience to people who want answers to the world's most dangerous questions. Each week on my new Ironclad Original, I get to take calls from people about self-defense, my experience in combat, gear, life-threatening scenarios, and other important subjects. I'll also be breaking down real-world footage of violent situations to help you, the viewer, understand what to do when it all goes down. This season, we'll have the opportunity to bring in high-profile guests, host surprise appearances, and do cool giveaways and a whole lot more. Make sure you guys subscribe to Dangerous Questions, an Ironclad Original, on YouTube at This Is Ironclad or wherever you get your podcasts.
How big is the monster of Facebook? And I'm not trying to use the term monster pejoratively, but I have this conversation with people, and for clarity, I know almost nothing about the internet or Facebook, and I feel like the people I'm talking to don't either. But we postulate on, you know, how much of Facebook is run by people versus machines? I mean, it seems like if they have on the 60 Minutes interview that I was watching with you, it said 2.8 billion users on Facebook, 60% of the people who are internet connected. Is that actually being run by people, or are people managing machines and processes?
So we're now actually up to something like 3.2 or 3.3 billion. So it's crazy, like half of 500 million more people. It's a huge number of people, more than the number of people in the United States are now on Facebook compared to when I came forward 2.5 years ago. Wow. I think one of the things that concerns me is, you know, part of why I came forward was the part of Facebook that was supposed to be concerned, at least when it came to social stability, around what's known as low prevalence, high severity problems. So that's like, you know, you have your typical interaction with the Facebook. In general, it's pretty good. It adds a lot of value to people's lives. But sometimes there's a, you know, that 1%, 2% that has a disproportionate negative outcome. You know, we need to have a group that is rewarded for thinking about complicated problems, that isn't just motivated to, or isn't incentivized to just move that number up without questioning, is this the right number? You know, there's that part of Facebook got dissolved after the 2020 election. On the flip side of that, so let's imagine now we're talking about kids, you know, the same people whose job was to advocate for the same kind of questions around well-being of children, you know, those teams were incredibly small. And so when we look at, again, this is one of these things that came out of the lawsuit from the AGs. And remember, 44 states are involved so far, right? 44 states never agree on anything except for maybe opiates, tobacco lawsuits. And one of the critical memos came out right after my testimony, where one of the most senior executives in the company wrote Mark Zuckerberg a memo and said, hey, we're saying, we're doing all these things publicly. We're not staffing our internal teams to actually do those things. Like, we have a gap, it's not huge. It's like 40 people. It's not like 100 people. It's not like 200 people. It's like maybe 40 people, maybe 20 of those are engineers. We just need some more people if we're gonna actually try to ask questions about kids' well-being. And that got shot down because there wasn't money available by the CFO, and Mark didn't back them up, right? So it's one of these things where—
wasn't money available in a $1 trillion company. Okay.
Yeah. They were making tens of billions of dollars of profit. And the Senate actually estimated back in January, like during the trial, the hearing, with all those tech CEOs, they estimated that we're talking about in the order of low tens of millions of dollars. Like, we're not even talking about $50 million for them to actually just meet what they said they were doing for kids. And they said that money just wasn't available.
And in the scope and scale of a business that's making billions per year, that's probably a day's revenue.
Tens of billions. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a day's revenue. That's round off error on their P&L. It's unconscionable to me that people can justify those decisions. And, this knee-jerk reaction is like, screw Facebook. Everybody should jump off of this. And then you remember the vast majority of the world uses it as a different mechanism than people checking in with their grandparents.
I got asked by a journalist today, if you could work at Facebook again, would you? And I gave the exact same answer I've given since the day I came forward, which is I would, of course, work for Facebook again, because we don't get to give up on it, right? Like, these companies, like, it's very easy to be critical of TikTok. It's very easy to be critical of Twitter. It's very easy to be critical of Facebook. Any of these companies, if they said, Francis, we'd like to offer you a job, as long as it wasn't like sit in the corner so you stop talking publicly, you know, as long as they offered me a real job where I could work on something, I would, because we don't get to give up on the systems. There's whole countries where small businesses don't have their own websites, they have Facebook pages. You don't call people on a phone number, you call them on WhatsApp. Like, we don't get to give up on these when the most vulnerable are the most dependent on them.
How aware do you think Mark Zuckerberg is about all of this?
Mm.
So that's again, so I have to say, like, you know, very, very infrequently am I like, have you read this legal filing? It's so juicy. Like, you know, very rarely am I going to tell you to read, you know, something written by a lawyer. But one of the things that's super interesting about the filing is I think they do a really good job of painting kind of a slice of life of what's it like to sit around an executive meeting with Mark Zuckerberg, right? So there are, you know, over and over again, executives tried to help him make responsible decisions, and he didn't rise to the opportunity. And you have to start asking questions around, like, you know, why? So one of the examples they call out in there is when Snapchat started doing augmented reality, and like everyone started getting excited about, like, you can be a cat, you know, that kind of thing. And Instagram rushed in and was like, we can do it too. And almost immediately someone made a filter that let you simulate plastic surgery. So you get all the markup, like, you know, drawn on your face with markers, they simulate afterwards, all the stuff.
That's what the world, you know, like, is. You do. Great.
Yeah. Oh, and that's what we need, like, 10-year-olds doing, right? Because remember, there's 10-year-olds on WhatsApp, there's 8-year-olds on WhatsApp, right? That the face palm is the correct gesture. So understandably, there was a huge press cycle being like, this is not a great idea. And so Facebook announces, we've banned, if you're simulating plastic surgery, that's banned. What they didn't tell people was, and I went to go look these articles up, because, like, I like to do a lot of visuals when I do public speaking. If you run a conference, what funds my work is public speaking, so I'm always available. So I like to have visuals of, like, when I tell stories like this, you know, this is what's going on. So I go looking for what's being described in this filing. And it doesn't say it's a temporary ban. It says it's banned. So in reality, it was only a 6-month ban. And during that 6 months, Meta hired 22 external experts to write a big report being like, is this bad? You know, like, you know, give us more context. And the experts wrote back and was like, this is bad. A bunch of internal executives were like, you know, we don't make any money on this. It's a horrible look. Like, you don't have to be a cognitive scientist who specializes in kids. No, this is bad. This is bad. We make no money from it. We just shouldn't do this. The executives got together. There was a meeting that was supposed to be with Mark to, like, be like, let's ban this for real. Like, this is it. Let's do a forever ban. The day before the meeting, he cancels the meeting. A week later, he sends out an email saying, this, you know, this feels really paternalistic. There's very clearly market demand for this. And I haven't seen any evidence of harms. And so it's like one of these things where, how is it possible, like, that there could be such a disconnect? And the only explanation I can come to is, you know, Mark has been building Facebook. He's been building Meta since he was 19 years old, right? Like, this company is inextricably part of his identity. You know, there's a saying, you know, it's very hard to convince someone of something that their livelihood depends on, right? Yeah. Like, it's something against it. In this case, I think it's even harder because, you know, if you say your product is hurting people, it's like my life's work is hurting people. And I think it's one of these things where he hasn't had a chance to emotionally mature from, like, being a 19-year-old. You know, he's always been the CEO. He's always been surrounded by people who told him, you're adding so much good to the world. It's, you know, you have to break a few eggs to make an omelet. And so I think that's where this weird cognitive dissonance comes in, is because he's so isolated and he hasn't had a chance to be like, you know, I can admit I have some flaws. I can admit I need to do some work. It doesn't mean I'm not also bringing a lot of good value to the world.
This week on Borderland, an Ironclad original, Vince talks to retired game warden and cartel expert John Norris.
I'm now in a gunfight with that shooter who's coming back around the corner to see what he's doing. Unbeknownst to me, I've got another gunman, this bad guy's partner, in a fortified position, concealed 7 yards ahead of me with a sawed-off shotgun with a 12 gauge with buckshot and another pistol. And literally, if my sheriff's deputies had not engaged that guy and seen him with their M4s, we wouldn't be having this conversation now, and nothing would have developed on us continuing to do that. So in that 8-second, you know, little firefight, everything changed.
Watch new episodes every Monday wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube at This Is Ironclad.
Yeah, it's one of those things where both can be true. You know, life, I have found, is not, it's not binary. It's not black and white. And I am by no means an expert on, the technical term would be anything, but I have my own eyes and I have my own ears. And like I said, I was a late adopter to social media. And I'm not a socioeconomic expert, but I have watched, you know, one of the things I do believe to be true is comparison is the thief of joy often. And when you watch people who, before they put a picture up on any social media platform, they run it through filters. And if you ask them, you know, well, why do you do that? Well, I don't, you know, my skin looks a little bit blemished, or, you know, it's generally an appearance issue. I don't even want to use the term issue. It's an appearance category that they want to shift. And if you ask them why, and I've done this many times, well, that's what this person's doing, and I like their pictures. And instead of looking at somebody else's pictures and saying, that's awesome, and being comfortable in your own skin, it's this horrible Jacob's ladder of escalation. Well, this person's doing that, and I guess if they're looking, somebody's looking at their picture and then looking at mine, it becomes a competition instead of a celebration of your own life. And I see it all. I mean, we all know people who on social media appear to be the happiest, the wealthiest, the most beautiful, and you see them in real life and they're an absolute dumpster fire. They're not happy. It's the opposite of what they're presenting on social media, because it is curated, and you watch these people curating themselves out of who they actually are. That's not healthy. And it talked about, again, to go back to the 60 Minute piece, the increase in suicidal ideations for young women, the increases in eating disorders and I think it was specifically using Instagram for both of those. It's like, okay, I'm not an expert, but let's see if I could reverse engineer this. Why would they feel that way? Maybe because they don't feel valued enough. Maybe because they don't feel good enough in comparison of their teens. They're looking at what becomes, this is the model female physique. Oh, I don't look like that, so I'm going to have to change my eating behavior. And then, like you mentioned beautifully in that piece, it drives them back to the app itself. It's this self-licking ice cream cone. And I don't know where that leads.
So this is one of these really interesting things. So, you know, people will say things like, should we just publish the algorithm? And I do think we should publish the algorithm. I think we should have transparency on these systems, right? We should be able to make real consumer choices. The free market should be able to innovate out of this. And we need data. We need real information to make consumer choices. I do think they should do that. But at the same time, the way in which these things are designed is they're kind of like, I don't want to say trash piles, but like, because there's no architect coming in and saying like, this is what I want the system to do. Like, this is how the parts are going to fit together. You know, we're going to do this, this, and this, and we're going to wiggle in that direction. Instead, people come in there and they run experiments and they say, was this better? Was this better? Was A better? Was B better? And if A gets better metrics than B, it goes out. And the only problem with this, and I think this is one of the most damning documents in the Facebook files, they were talking about how during COVID, and we can agree, disagree on like what to do about COVID misinformation. I think a lot of mistakes were made, but we can have a longer conversation. They ran an experiment where they're like, hey, we know we have this known misinformation. We're going to demote it 90%. So we're going to take a score, knock the score down by 90%. Because this thing was such a ball of spaghetti, you know, scores could range by so much because it was just like people slapping on little bonuses and rewards and whatever. Even with a 90% demotion, something might stay in the top 10 posts on your feed 20% of the time, right? They had no clue how to influence the machine because the machine had become so unwieldy. And so you have to also be transparent about outcomes data. Like, we should have the right to see every post that gets more than 10,000 views, because it's not private anymore. And it would let us see what the biases are in these systems. And then we can ask questions and say, do I really want to be on this system or this system, given like this is what it's rewarding?
Ladies and gentlemen, today's episode is also brought to you by Mountain Tough. It's a unique functional fitness program that is, of course, supported by hunters and SEALs and Rangers and those from the special operations community. But that is not my favorite part of the Mountain Tough system or program. Although it was developed with insights from the backcountry hunter and veteran special operations community, there is an emphasis on more than just physical strength, which I believe to be essential. It is also about building an unbreakable mind. It is easy to build muscles from the neck down. It is far more difficult to build muscles from the neck up and the resilience between your ears. The Mountain Tough app provides the best functional fitness program directly to your phone, tablet, TV, or a web browser. So you really don't have an excuse to say, oh, I didn't know what I could be doing or should be doing, whether it's a program or inspiration or insight. It's all right there at the touch of your fingers. Some of you might be saying, well, I'm not a ex-special operations personnel. I'm also not a backcountry hunter. That's okay. For those of you who might not start out as an elite athlete, but you want to improve wherever you may be, Mountain Tough is determined to push everybody's limits. And they're going to meet you where you are with thoughtful programming, helping you achieve elite status through progressive fitness, focusing on longevity, injury prevention, and holistic development. It's a story arc from wherever you are, getting as close to elite as could possibly be. So what are you waiting for? You can join the global Mountain Tough community right now. A community of people transforming their lives, bodies, and minds. Download the Mountain Tough app today and start training to always be ready for whatever it is you're trying to be ready for the backcountry, for the mission, or just life's unexpected challenges. Because when it comes to being prepared, there's no excuse to not start now. You can use the code CHANGE, which I'm looking at all capital letters, one word, at mountaintough.com on the monthly plan to get your first month absolutely free after your 14-day free trial. That's 6 weeks free to dive in, test the waters, the programming, and make sure it's actually for you. What are you waiting for? You can change your life today. Be ready for the mountains, the mission, and just life in general. Ladies and gentlemen, Four Branches Bourbon is the only spirits company founded by veterans from the Army, Navy, Marines, and Air Force. These veterans collaborated with a Bourbon Hall of Fame master distiller and legend to help them make their smooth but complex blend of four-grain and 96-proof bourbon, blended and bottled in Bardstown, Kentucky. It is often said that bourbon without a story is just brown water, and this bourbon has a story with over 100 combined years of military service around the world. At Four Branches, they are not just crafting some of the finest bourbon, but they are reshaping the drinking narrative. Their motto, drink honorably, embodies their ethos of sipping to remember, not to forget. And as veterans, we get to come home while others did not. So if you're going to drink, please drink honorably, and don't drink to forget, but let's sip to remember. And if you are going to sip and you like bourbon, this has a very interesting taste. Not that I'm a bourbon connoisseur or expert, but smoother than I thought it would be. I've had some bourbons that about ripped my face off. This was the exact opposite. So please enjoy honorably. If you want to learn more about Four Branches, please check out their story at fourbranches.com and pick up a bottle of their fine bourbon today using the code IRONCLAD10. That is all one word, iron, normal spelling, C-L-A-D, 10. You're going to get 10% off. So I'm going to guess that organizations like Facebook are resistant to the idea of truly publishing their algorithm. And if the answer to that, or if that is true, my first question would be, why? Would they base that in, like, this is IP and, you know, we like trade secrets, they would try to justify it that way? Or do they just, in your opinion, not want people to see what is really going on behind the curtain?
Simple, right? Like, you know, one of the trends that's kind of terrifying across all these platforms is what little data we used to have on how they performed, we are losing. So it used to be at Twitter, we had a fire hose, which was like, see everything that got posted on Twitter, you know, you can analyze it. We had a thing called CrowdTangle for Facebook that would let you see like what were, how were posts being engaged with. That's closing in August, right before the election. TikTok doesn't really have any equivalent kind of thing. These were our little windows into these systems. And part of why they're shutting down quite clearly is because they get embarrassed, they get, you know, people find stuff and they ask for more. So in the case of TikTok, like a couple of kind of embarrassing stories came out when they trial run, they had an API that was allowing researchers to ask questions about TikTok. Almost immediately, they found things that looked a little dubious. And as a result, they were like, oh, we're not going to do this. When we have information about these systems, we ask questions. We ask for more. We ask for different things. And it's much, much easier to be able to have a relationship where you hold all the cards, because then you don't have to negotiate with another person's wants or needs. You don't have to figure out how to build experiences that meet them. You can just say, no, 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 we're doing everything we can.
I don't know if it's a healthy relationship if one party holds all the cards. Do you think that Facebook is capable of course correcting with Mark Zuckerberg at the helm?
So I always like to say we should have a free Mark campaign. It's like, are you familiar with Free Britney?
I swear I've heard that. And if we're going to talk about Britney Spears, it scares the shit out of me. So I have.
It should, right, though. It should. It should. It should scare the shit out of you. Like, well, as I go in, you're going to get scared. So
yeah, people were fighting for her to get out of her conservancy, right?
So Mark Zuckerberg and Britney rose to their power in their teenage years. They're surrounded by people. They were both surrounded by people. Britney's now free, so like it's a little bit less weird now. They're surrounded by people who make a huge amount of money because they keep Mark where he is or keep Britney where she is. They've both made public statements about how miserable they are. So Mark has gone on podcasts and said, you know, when I look at my phone in the morning, it's like getting punched in the face. And yet, like, these systems don't change because everyone around Mark says, oh, no, 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 Mark, only you can direct the ship. And for context for listeners, a key thing that both of us have left out till now is Mark Zuckerberg is unique amongst all the social media companies in that he truly holds all the cards. He has 55, 56, depends on the day, 55% of all the votes for Facebook. He doesn't get 55% of the profits, but he gets 55% of the votes because of the share structure. And that means if he wants to do something, it happens. If he doesn't want to do something, it happens. It means everyone beneath him holds their jobs at his pleasure. He's the chairman of the board, he's the CEO. You know, in the addiction community, they talk about the idea that people don't emotionally mature beyond the point at which they start using. So if you start drinking when you're 19 and you stop drinking when you're 35, you know, you act a lot like a 19-year-old. Like, you don't know how to solve problems the way a 35-year-old does because you haven't been coping. You haven't been learning all these other coping skills or ways of navigating the world. You just drink to compensate. And I think in the case of Mark, like, he's never had to grow up. You know, he's been surrounded by people who tell him, you know, he's wonderful. He's doing everything he can. They know not to bring him things that he won't like. Like, for example, the thing about the notifications and the kids. You know, you look at the quotes from these emails. People are like, you know, the results are really clear, but like, he really cares about that metric. He cares about, you know, total minutes spent or whatever the hell it is. You know, there's no point. Like, we shouldn't bring it to them. We shouldn't push on this. So I think it's one of those things where it's not just that you're going to have to remove Mark. Like, Mark's going to need to go step down or like go on to solve some wonderful problem. You know, he's a young man. He has infinite money. Like, go solve malaria. Like, go become Bill Gates. Like, have people like you more. And it's not just going to have to be him. It's going to be probably another layer or two under him are going to get replaced. But when Steve Jobs went and restarted Apple, you know, he fired like a third of all the managers. So these are systems that can, like, systems can be changed. Systems can be healed. We can have nice things, but we have to put in place the opportunities for better behavior to take place.
Do you remember the moment when you realized it was time for you to leave?
Like, actually quit, like, or blow the whistle? Which one?
Blow the whistle. The moment when you realized, okay, I'm going to need to start collecting this information because I'm going to do something with it for the betterment of people outside of this entity.
It's interesting. So like there was a slightly different moment from the moment I was like, I knew I'd have to do something. And the moment where I was like, I'm going to have to document XYZ. So like there were a lot of things there around, like, you know, part of what made my whistle blow a little bit different than others was like, I did it in a much more like structured and intentional way, which is part of why I think it's been as effective as it has been. I mean, that took time. But the moment I was like, this is just insanity, was sitting on the call where they got rid of our team. Because like, actually it was one of the moments, oh my God, sorry, I'm just like thinking back on this. So when I joined Facebook, one of the refrains I heard over and over again was talking about the Russians in 2016 is so ridiculous. I mean, they only spent like $11,000 or $17,000 in ads. Like, they're not a big deal. Like, that's the line I heard over and over again for like a year and a half. And then comes this call, and they're dissolving our team. And one of the people who worked on the war room that dealt with all the aftermath of the 2016 election gets on there, and he says something totally different. So this is the line I've heard inside the company for a year and a half. Like, it's so overblown. They spent $11,000. Who cares? He got on there and said, yeah, you know, I'm so glad to be taking on part of the team. Like, you know, I've always cared about this issue. I was on the war room that dealt with Russia after 2016. You know, we were really amazed. They spent $11,000 and reached half of all Americans, right? Like, they figured out exactly how to parlay all these different things to kind of insert themselves in all these different communities and like bootstrap this whole thing. And they were talking to half of all Americans by the time they were done. And I was like, oh, no one told me that for the last 18 months, right? And that's the kind of thing that I saw over and over inside of Facebook, was that like, it's an echo chamber. Like, there are messages you're allowed to repeat, and there's messages you're not allowed. Like, the people, you know, if you start talking about anything negative, people pull back, because it's not a culture that celebrates conflict. It's not a culture that celebrates disagreement. And that kind of culture flows from the top.
Yeah. Do you think society is better off or worse off in general due to the creation of social media?
What a great question. So I think the topic that we don't spend enough time talking about is, I think this is a kind of like processed food, right? Like there's this conversation around ultra processed food. You know, should you eat extruded, you know, corn, cheesy nozzle, whatever's, versus like, go have some vegetables. And, you know, we're learning all these things about how eating ultra processed food changes your microbiome, it changes, you know, propensity to gain weight, all these other things, heart disease, whatever. But at the same time, it also fills a really big need, because there's a lot of people who all they can afford is ultra processed food.
Yeah.
One of the things that's really hard to kind of untease is, before social media existed, we had already had 30 years of our social fabric inside the United States free. Like, there's a famous book called Bowling Alone that's about how, you know, if we rolled back in time to the 60s and 70s, people belonged to Elks lodges. They belonged to their Veterans of Foreign Wars lodges. They had bowling leagues. They went to church. You know, you had a garden club. You know, you socialized in person. And by the early 2000s, a lot of that had frayed. And it's not because of the internet. It's because, like, people didn't have as much money. You didn't have as much time. People lived further apart, yada, yada, yada. So like, Facebook didn't create that, but I think it has accelerated it, because when, you know, as it gets harder and harder to socialize in person, it's easier and easier just to retreat back on social media. You know, the difference between having a real friend and having a parasocial relationship with a podcaster, with a YouTuber, is, you know, having a real relationship is a lot of work. You know, you have to make time. You might not have a lot of energy left after work. You know, Netflix is so convenient. And so I think it's on net negative, right? I think there were lots of wonderful things about the internet that gave people most of the good parts of social media. And yet we've lost a lot of that actual real online community, because, you know, a few companies get to spoon feed us algorithmic content that, you know, like Cheez-Its, is delicious, but may not be the thing that actually nurtures our souls.
I tend to agree with you on it being, I think maybe the needle, like, there's times when it maybe tips over into positive, but I think it probably sits just a little bit under the negative. And, you know, people, let me tell you what season I'm not looking forward to, which is the 2024 electoral cycle, where we're bombarded with shit that I don't want to hear about 24/7. And I think about politics, And I feel like we need a maximum dosage of somebody allowed in the political spectrum, because even like aspirin or ibuprofen can be very beneficial, mm-hmm. but if you take it in too high of a dosage, it can be fatal. And I look at politics, and I don't know if it's people who want to go into politics because they want their own power, or does the system itself corrupt them, the best of people, and they turn up. Doesn't matter. I think it is an unhealthy environment to have a career in. And I look at social media. I'm like, okay, there are so many great things, this ability to communicate across the world. But I think the limiting, the thing that keeps it slightly negative is the vast majority of time that people will spend on it. I think we could keep it at neutral, and I'm not advocating for this, but it's something that I think about, if there was a maximum dosage allowed. And I don't know if that'd be per, like, per week or month, whatever. People could figure that out. But just like anything else that has an unknown consequence, like, oh, this water that you're about to swim in has mercury in it, you know, or a low level. And if you spend more than an hour in there, it's probably going to be pretty dangerous. Well, most people are not going to spend more than an hour in there. And maybe, even though this would be acting in complete contradiction to his own self-interest, Mr. Zuckerberg could put some throttling mechanisms that at a certain point in time, it's like, sorry, you're done for today. I think it would help. And I also think it's impossible for them to make that decision.
This is one of these fascinating things. So all social media platforms follow something called a power law. So that means most people consume, you know, Facebook for 20 minutes, 30 minutes a day, like not a huge amount of time. As you get farther and farther away from that more common experience, people consume more and more. So the 99th percentile, like the 1% of people who use it the most, they don't use it twice as much. They use it 100 times as much. Mm-hmm. So they don't look at 30 posts a day and spend like 20 minutes. They look at 3,000 posts a day, look at 2,000 posts a day. They leave 100 times as many comments. They leave 100 times as many like likes and, you know, reshares. And the problem, what's so fascinating about your idea of like, you know, let's just set a cap. Like the cap could actually be pretty big. It could be like 2 hours a day. And it would actually change everything, because those people who spend 15 hours a day on Facebook, you know, who wake up, they're on there all day, they go to sleep. And there are people like this, you know, maybe they live in a slightly more isolated environment. Maybe they have a physical limitation. Maybe they can't afford to socialize in person. You never know. They influence the media environment for everyone else because they're the ones putting signal into the machine. You know, they're the ones putting out content. And so there's an interesting thing of, you know, just making it a little more level, saying everyone gets their 2 hours a day, that would change everything, even for the people who right now, you know, because they'd have a different experience.
Well, and unfortunately, it would change the ad revenue as well. And that is where we likely bump up against the resistance from Mr. Zuckerberg. We said at the beginning, we're going to leave people with a positive note. I feel like people are like smashing their phones or just cursing me out for my idea to limit their, how dare you limit my access to social media? It's like an idea. I'm not like a totalitarian person trying to force that. I will, to be respectful of your time, I know we're coming up to the end here.
Yeah.
Leave us with something positive, Francis. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean.
So it's so interesting. So I do a lot of college speaking at college campuses. And again, remember, my nonprofit is largely funded by my speaking. So if you have an opportunity, let me know. But I go to these college campuses and it's so interesting talking to college kids because they live so intensely in the consequences of these systems. And, you know, I'll answer questions, we'll talk about stuff, and I can feel the energy levels draining. Like it's so different even talking to adults because they live, this is their world. And so I've learned over time that it's really important to remind people that this moment feels so different. It feels like apocalyptic sometimes. But the reality is every single time we have invented a new communication technology, it has been wildly disruptive. Right. So like inventing the printing press was actually not that disruptive because no one could read. Right. Like when the printing press came out, it was like 3% of Europe could read. It was mostly priests. Even nobles didn't read because like, why would you bother? Teaching people to read, that was disruptive. You know, you get pamphlets on like burning your neighbor as a witch and stuff, like all kinds of crazy stuff. You get wars over religion and other things. The newspaper, right? The cheap printing press. We had whole wars fought over misinformation. Like people were able to cause wars by just printing about it. But we learned, we adapted. You know, we invented journalism schools and journalistic ethics and media concentration rules so you could hear from different voices. No one could control it, the whole echo chamber. You know, telegraph. Like, the telegraph didn't cause the Civil War, but a lot of academics think it influenced when the Civil War happened. Because for the first time, people could find out that someone who lived far away from them didn't agree with them. Like, they had never, like, realized that before, because information moves so much more quickly. Radio, you know, radio led to the rise of dictators in Europe, because for the first time, you could have an emotional relationship with your leader. But we learned, we adapted. Again, we instituted things like public media. We invested in more sources. We did concentration rules. So you couldn't control the echo chamber. All these things are about control. They're all about understanding where the power is, how we adapt to it, who gets to influence it. Do you even get to know that influence is happening? Right now, we feel overwhelmed because this is our moment to learn and adapt and change. And our responsibility feels overwhelming. But the reality is, every single time before, when we have, you know, gone off the rails with some new media technology, that's what we've done. And we're going to do it again. And so I look forward to seeing what world we build together, because the world changes because we change it.
Hope you enjoyed today's episode. And I hope that it stopped you in your tracks a little bit and makes you think about the role of social media in your own life, in our communities, and the globally connected community that the world is now, and even more so if you have children, the role that it could play or what it is playing in the role of your children's lives. If you want to learn more about this issue, you can read Francis's book, The Power of One. Thank you again for listening to Change Agents, an Ironclad original presented by Montana Knife Company. I'll be back next week with an all-new guest and episode.